The Leon Panetta 2016 Lecture Series, An America in Renaissance or Decline, The Challenges Facing a New President. This lecture discusses war, terrorism, and other global threats. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mrs. Sylvia Panetta.
Good evening, everyone. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the Carmel Sunset Cultural Center in beautiful Carmel by the Sea for the Leon Panetta 2016 Lecture Series. We're thrilled to bring the lecture series to Carmel. Not only do we get to present the program in this wonderful theater, but the size of this venue has meant that we've been able to reach out to more individuals and invite them to share in these important discussions. And it has allowed us to host more students for this lecture. By the way, we had over 600 students today. That's an all-time high, and we're very pleased. Leon and I want to extend a special thanks to the City Council of Carmel for inviting us to bring this program to this lovely town for the 2016 season. Thank you, Carmel. As we move ever closer to the presidential elections in November and read headline after headline of insults and bickering rather than thoughtful discussion of issues, events like the Leon Panetta Lecture Series become more and more important. When we go to the polls this fall, we'll perform our most important role as members of our democracy. We'll decide who will lead our great nation. The choice we make will determine whether we will have an America in renaissance or become a nation in decline. We owe it to future generations to make the most informed choice we can. During the 19th season of the Leon Panetta Lecture Series, we will examine the key challenges facing the next president. We'll look at foreign policy, national security, the economy, political dysfunction, and changes in our society like technology. All topics that will define the course of our republic in the rest of this 21st century. Joining Secretary Panetta on stage this evening will be leading scholars, policy experts, former elected officials, diplomats, respected journalists, and military experts representing both parties in a variety of points of view. Tonight, we begin with war, terrorism, and other global threats. In 2013, when Secretary Panetta returned to the lecture series, Osama bin Laden had been brought to justice. The United States was preparing to bring the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to a close. And there was hope that the Arab Spring would spread democracy throughout the Middle East. Today, ISIS is grabbing more territory in Syria and through social media is recruiting supporters around the globe. Both Iraq and Afghanistan have returned to violent instability. Russia has assumed a newly aggressive stance. China is showing new military strength and the threat of a catastrophic cyber attack grows every day. Given these serious and varied threats, how can we protect our nation and promote stability around the globe? Whoever is elected will be the nation's commander-in-chief. Will a new president bring a new era of global peace and stability, or will war, unrest, and violence continue to threaten our world? We will pose these questions to three foreign policy experts representing the intelligence, diplomatic, and military communities. Our first guest deployed for both Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm. In 2003, during Operation Iraqi Freedom, the division under his command was responsible for the capture of Saddam Hussein. He served as the operational commander of the surge of forces in Iraq and went on to lead the multinational force. As the 38th Chief of Staff of the Army, he commanded more than 1 million servicemen and women. As a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was a key advisor to Secretary Panetta. Prior to that, he was assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and then primary military advisor to Secretaries of State Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. In total, he has spent more time in Iraq than any other United States general. A graduate of West Point and the Army War College, please welcome a distinguished military officer, General Ray Odierno. Our second guest has 3 decades of experience in international affairs and politics. She was Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs for Secretary of State Warren Christopher and went on to serve as counselor of the State Department as well as special advisor and policy coordinator on North Korea for President Bill Clinton. As Undersecretary for Political Affairs in the Obama administration, she was the State Department's number 3 official and served as lead negotiator in the successful effort to complete the Iran nuclear agreement. In recognition of her many diplomatic accomplishments, President Barack Obama awarded her the National Security Medal. A graduate of Boston University with a master's from University of Maryland, please welcome a distinguished diplomat, Ambassador Wendy Sherman. Our final guest is a well-respected intelligence expert on national security. Before being elected to the United States Congress in 2000, he was a commissioned officer in the United States Army and later served as an FBI special agent. He was appointed chairman of the House Intelligence Committee in 2011 and was a member of the powerful Energy and Commerce Panel. During that time, he led the Intelligence Committee. America witnessed the operation that brought Osama bin Laden to justice, the debate surrounding the NSA leaks by Edward Snowden, the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, and Russia's annexation of Crimea. He is now a CNN national security commentator and also appears in major print outlets. A distinguished legislator, chairman, and intelligence expert, please welcome Mike Rogers.
Thank you. Good to see you. Thank you.
Moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 19 years ago, the chairman of the Panetta Institute, former director of the CIA, and former Secretary of Defense. Please welcome Secretary Leon Panetta. I love you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 19th annual Panetta Lecture Series. We're enjoying this great venue of the Sunset Auditorium. I have to tell you, I may be a little nervous because the last time I was on this stage was when I was 12 years old, and I gave a piano concert here in this place, 1951. I had my parents drive me around the block three times before I came in here. I'm sure my parents, wherever they are asking, where the hell did you go wrong? But I'm back on the stage with these distinguished speakers to talk about some very challenging issues that are going to face the next president of the United States. Intelligence reports tell us that we do live in a dangerous world. And perhaps so dangerous that it will challenge the next president in terms of the ability to maintain peace in the world. We're looking at a number of flashpoints. We're fighting ISIS and terrorism. We're dealing with a Middle East that is in chaos. Failed states in Syria and Libya and Yemen. We're dealing with threats from rogue states like Iran and North Korea. We're dealing with what some have called a new chapter in the Cold War with Russia, a much more aggressive Putin than we've seen in the past. And we're dealing with China. We have a huge economic relationship with China, but at the same time, they are making territorial claims in the South China Sea and militarizing some of the islands in that part of the world. And we're also dealing with the new battlefield of the 21st century, which is cyber warfare. Cyber has the potential to literally cripple this country. So there are a huge number of issues that will face the next president of the United States, who I think we have to always remind ourselves is going to be the commander-in-chief of the United States. And we'll have to deal with these issues. And that brings me really to my first question, which is, if a new president were to call you in and ask you, what is the greatest threat that I am confronting as president of the United States, the greatest threat to our national security, what would you tell him? Mike?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here. There's very few people could get these distinguished guests to come all the way across the country to be here, so we should really thank Sylvia for that. I wouldn't have happened without Sylvia. There are so many new threats. You talked about many of them. The militarization of space, the fact that China is trying to push out its territorial waters in the South China Sea, 40% of the world's trade. We have cyber attacks exponentially growing year over year. And we've seen very bad behavior from nation states now using it as a destructive attack, both here in America and around the world. I argue the number one issue we should be concerned about is miscalculation. The fact that you have the North Koreans very aggressively pushing the envelope, certainly on its nuclear weapon program, Iran playing these proxy wars efforts around the Middle East. The fact that China is increasing its navy, should have about 350 ships by 2020, we're going to have about 80. The sheer aggressiveness of Vietnam and Japan and others trying to push back. We're likely to have a maritime skirmish. We're likely to have something happen in space. We're likely to have an event in cyberspace that is maybe not catastrophic, but pretty darn serious. How do we react? How does the President of the United States react to that first crisis that will likely happen very shortly after the next president takes office? That is my biggest concern up front. How do you prepare the military? How do you prepare the structure of the next presidency to deal with trying to de-escalate whatever military confrontation happens? And yeah, if you, again, you look at the surface area of problem in the national security space today, something is gonna happen. It's that miscalculation that I worry about. Somebody miscalculates, and instead of de-escalating, it begins to escalate. We've got a lot of folks out there we have defense pacts with that we'd have to defend. How are we going to deal with that miscalculation? You know, there's lots of other problems out there. I would argue that's the number one issue for the next president.
Wendy?
I certainly think that Chairman Rogers has laid out what we all think of as the big threats in front of us, but I'd add a couple of things to it. First of all, we are all used to dealing in history with state actors, with countries. We think there are rules of order around how you do that and what the response is. We have lots of examples in our history. but we have a lot of non-state actors. And those non-state actors are not only the terrorists, which we all think of, who aren't governed by any of the rules of the road. They create their own agenda and their own road. And so we have to think about this quite differently than perhaps we've thought about other things. And we have non-state actors and non-state threats like climate change, which aren't governed by a particular country, but are covered by the air that we breathe, the water that we drink. And we know that when there is not enough water, which you all know here quite well, when there's not enough water, when we don't have the energy needs of people around the world met, we know that conflict increases. So those transnational threats, whether it's terrorism or climate change or drug trafficking or human trafficking, are all things, refugees, that we all need to deal with. And then the last thing I would say, just like Mike talked about miscalculation, I worry fundamentally about leadership. Whoever is the President of the United States has to really take on the mantle of the fact that the United States of America is the greatest country on the face of the earth. We are the largest and most important economy. There is a rising China, no doubt about it, but we are still, by GDP and by per capita, the largest economy. We have a military that no one else can match. We have an intelligence capability that no one else can match. And we, as Leon pointed out, we are in an era where we cannot not take on the responsibility that is ours. Everywhere we all travel and we all compare notes, people say to us, we are ready to do our part, but America must lead. So this is not a time for the United States to retreat. That doesn't mean we go everywhere and do everything, but it does mean that we do lead. And there are very tough choices to be made for all of the reasons that both Leon and Mike pointed out and that General Odierno knows so well. And we have to not be afraid to understand who we are and what we bring to the world.
Ray, greatest threat.
I think there's two things that I would say is, first, as a military leader, I worry about the multitude of threats that we face and the potential to face them simultaneously is a new challenge for us. And the fact that you might have one threat and one adversary try to take advantage of action going on in another place, which leads to potential miscalculation. The second thing I fear most is this idea of isolationism and disengagement from the rest of the world. I think it's incredibly dangerous for us at this time to disengage ourselves. As was mentioned by the ambassador, there's never been a more important time that I believe we need U.S. leadership around the world. And if we decide to disengage and isolate ourselves, it will frankly make the problems worse, not better. And it will ultimately cause us potentially in the future to have to respond in a much larger way than we probably would like to. So in my mind, it's important to stay engaged, it's important to have strong leadership, and it's important for us to have the capability to conduct simultaneous operations on different continents, because I think that could be a requirement here in the near future.
All right, let's turn to some of these specific threats. ISIS. This September, it'll be 15 years since 9/11. 15 years of fighting this war on terrorism. We clearly have had some successes. We've decimated Al-Qaeda's key leadership in Pakistan. We took down bin Laden. And we have prevented another 9/11 type attack. But clearly terrorism has metastasized. And we see it with ISIS, we see it with Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and other elements of Al-Qaeda. President of the United States has said that our mission should be to defeat ISIS. We have conducted airstrikes. We have special forces that have been deployed there. We have trainers and advisors that are trying to train the Iraqis and others to be able to fight ISIS and move them out of this territory. We're dealing with a threat now that is a quasi-state. They own a huge amount of territory in that part of the world. And they have conducted attacks in Paris, San Bernardino. Are we defeating ISIS? And if not, what is the strategy to get that accomplished?
I would say first that we have sustained and reduced their capabilities and their ability to expand in claiming territory within Iraq and Syria. But I believe ISIS, I call it a symptom. It's a symptom of places where you have failed governments, failing governments, ungoverned territory. And so in order to defeat a network of capability that is starting to spread to North Africa and other areas, you need a network of capabilities to defeat that threat. So I don't believe we can defeat it with air power alone. And I think there's limits to military power as well. But I believe we need to use a combination of ground capability, of coalition forces led by US capability, along with air power. We have to go after their money. We have to be able to cut off their network of funding. We have to challenge them in social media and on the internet and make it very difficult for them to continue to recruit. We need to build a coalition of capability that will help us to solve the problem once we defeat them, because I believe we will on the ground, is then what comes next, what comes after the day after? What is the governance solution that will allow us to sustain long-term impact? I am scarred by this a little bit because I would argue that in 2010, in Iraq was peaceful, Iraq was growing economically, but what we didn't have is a plan to govern after we left. And once we left, the government failed, and we then went back into this violent cycle. And if we don't have a plan to solve that, this time we'll run the same cycle. But US can't do it alone. It's got to be a coalition of Arab, NATO, all countries involved. It's got to be a simultaneous network of activity that challenges them on several different fronts. And by doing this, I think we can defeat them. It is not a short-term answer. It's going to take time. And we have to be patient enough and have the willpower to do this, because if we don't, ultimately, it will end up inside of our shores.
Wendy?
I think I'd build on what the general has said. Governance is a staggeringly difficult issue. I think everybody here probably recalls the days when we talked about nation building and we said that wasn't such a good idea because we were laying all the responsibility on us to do something that countries needed to learn how to do for themselves. We've had times when we've run anti-corruption campaigns or one campaign or another. We've talked about how to build the institutions of democracy. All of these are pieces of a puzzle, but it is a very complex puzzle, and it does not happen over time. We didn't grow our own nation in a decade. We are still perfecting our nation, and we will for some time to come. But we've learned something about how to help countries build their own competence, their own capability, take ownership for their governance, because once you are in a country, once you have held territory, unless you have a governance structure to put in, you're going to find yourself, as the general said, right back to the beginning. So on top of dealing with recruitment, financing, the actual military operations to take out terrorists, which we have to do, to help countries really solidify their gains, they have to hold that territory, and then they have to put governance structures in place that can be sustained over time. Otherwise, we will have ungoverned space, we will have safe havens, and we'll be back to the beginning again. It's a tough, complex operation that will take a very long time.
Mike?
You know, one of the things I think we should learn both by mistakes of decisions that we make that have consequences and decisions we make don't make that also have consequences. And we ought to take a total look at the last, really, 16 years and see where those decisions made had a positive impact or negative impact, and same with outmaking decisions. Our decisions that we could have taken 6 years ago against ISIS building up in eastern Syria, the options were never great, but they were better. And then 5 years, they were starting to deteriorate. 4 years, deteriorate. 3 years, deteriorate, till we find ourselves now where there's just not a lot of great options. But if you think about how far they've come, they're in operational in about 11 countries, operating in about 24 countries, ISIS as we know them today. There is an FBI field investigation in all 50 states into ISIS activities. So that means every FBI office in the country is working an ISIS case of somebody either sympathizing, raising money, or, God forbid, engaged in activities worse than that. And so that's a problem. And the narrative, we've never been able to change the narrative. And my argument was early on, and I completely agree with both the general and the ambassador, but we also need to disrupt their narrative. Their narrative is They've been at it for a long time. Guess what? We're winning. We're still here. We've chased some of the folks out. Canada left. They're not even doing it anymore, bombing anymore. And so that narrative, they use that very effectively. It was, you know, it's VHS tape of Al-Qaeda, you know, versus, you know, fancy new Twitter and social media campaign on ISIS. And the difference is incredible. So they have full operations, 90,000 tweets a day, recruiting, messaging, trying to make sure that the people around the world who are sympathetic to their cause understand that they believe they're winning. That's a huge problem for us. So I argue if in the short term, we have to do something that changes the narrative. And I agree, this is not the job for big conventional military forces. We're going to have to rebuild some of the coalition efforts, but you have to do something to change the narrative. And there have been some things. So, matter of fact, today they announced they got the Chechen, which is a very symbolic senior leader in the cause. He was actually one of their better combatant leaders on the ground in Syria, and he was an ISIS sympathizer. Taking him off the battlefield, good day, strike one for the world, and a good day for America, good day for civilization. But it has to be more than that. We need to start telling the rest of the folks who are still showing up to fight that it's a losing cause, that the United States and our Western allies and our Middle Eastern allies are coming together to change that outcome.
Let me pick up on what you just said, because obviously, learning from 9/11, what happened was we really developed our capability to track the terrorists, to be able to follow their communications, to know when they were putting a potential threat together, and be able to get that kind of information. Now, obviously, we're dealing with a group that are very good on social media, but we've run into this problem. Between Apple and the FBI, in which the information that the FBI is trying to get from one of the cell phones that was used by one of the terrorists involves having to break the encryption and get that information. Apple has now challenged that, said it jeopardizes their business and the rights of privacy of all those that are using those kinds of iPhones. How do we deal with this challenge? Because yes, we have to protect our freedoms, but we also have to protect our security. How do we find that balance that allows us to be able to protect Americans from the potential of another attack?
Yeah. So I'm a former FBI agent. My first reaction was, well, this shouldn't be an issue. Apple should give the phone so that the FBI can get it. I said earlier, much to, I think I'm still in trouble with the tweets I'm getting now, is that as an old FBI agent, you want to screw the gun in the guy's ear and say, give me the phone and give me the information. I can say that. I'm not in Congress anymore. I can. That's not the right answer either. And so one of the things that has been really interesting to watch is that we have it's a new age of American national security. Some of our strongest allies, their economics, their economic relationships are now separating a little bit from their national security interests. And the best case for that, and there's others, is Australia. They are locked at the hip with us. They are one of some of our best partners in the world on intelligence and military planning and diplomacy. They have never wavered, not once. And the problem now is that their economics are changing, even a place like South China Sea, because about 27% of their GDP is exports to China. So sometimes when you're talking about making big national security decisions, they have to have that conversation about, yes, I want to push back on China too, but there's a difference. I look at this as the same issue. The same issue that why we have a big blue water navy. We decided as a country, thanks to Thomas Jefferson, that we were going to create a big blue water navy, not to go around the world and thump on people, but to protect goods and services of the United States delivered anywhere in the world unmolested. And it was a stroke of genius. We became steadily over time the biggest, best economy in the world, and really nobody messes with us along the way. And if you have any doubt, ask the Somali pirates off the coast. They had a small little navy incursion, didn't work out all that well for them. And it sent a very strong signal that we will not have our goods and services molested anywhere in the world. So we have already decided that we can join our national security purpose for economic purposes. So I think we solve this issue this way, because I think it's important that Apple have the ability and opportunity to continue to sell and be a great American company and sell in China and have an encrypted option there, sell in Iran to have an encrypted option there, so the government doesn't abuse the people in the country for expressing their discomfort with the government. Same with Russia. So now, how do we align our economic interests with our security interests? I think this can be done. I think it's going to be pretty difficult. But what we're trying to do is find the right people who can find the right technology. Technology today is, we can't do it, we won't do it, we're not a part of it. Part of it is this, Ambassador and I have had many conversations about this, the ramping up, the FBI ramping up the rhetoric, and I think, as an FBI, I think it was unfortunate that we're having this fight in the front pages of the newspapers. A lot of this could have been worked out in other better suited places for a better outcome, probably, but we are where we are. So can we find the right technology that answers the needs of a company like Apple and meets our national security needs, meaning third-party encrypted keys at a very high level that regenerate on each use? I think it's there's companies out there that can do this. Can we translate that so everybody comes out of this where you don't have to say, I'm balancing one or the other, I'm sacrificing a little of that to get a little of that? I think you can do this in a way where you don't have to sacrifice anything. That Fourth Amendment to the Constitution is the guidepost for FBI agents to go into the court to get a warrant to get into someone's house to read their papers, which was the original intent of this. How does the government go about doing that legally and appropriately with oversight? That's really what we're looking for here. It's not that they should never do it. It's not you can do anything you want, the government can't look. Nope, here's your rights, and by the way, if the government needs to peek around your curtain, here's how they have to do it. This is a very high standard they have to meet. I think we can do both, and we're going to have to answer this question, but we should do it soon rather than later, and we ought to try to come together. Right now, everybody's in their neutral corners, and no one's having an honest intellectual debate about this. We need to get to that debate.
Wendy,
I think two things. One is that a lot of times problems are best solved quietly. And that's just antithetical to the social media world that we live in the 24/7 media world we live in. But if you look at four very tough cases of diplomacy, Cuba, Middle East peace, Iran, and North Korea, the two that have had some success, and we can debate the success, Cuba policy now and Iran, began to get traction in the negotiation in secret. This issue probably could have been solved if it had been done quietly without sort of everybody starting to beat their chest and saying, you know, no, I'm better or bigger than you are. And so it's hard to do that in our world, but it is critical, just like up on Capitol Hill, to get past some of the partisan gridlock around national security. When people have been able to quietly have discussions, they occasionally even can get something done. So that's point one. And the second I would say is we are in a whole new world. Not only in the Apple situation, but we are having changes in our economy that are phenomenal. Technology is going to play an essential part of everything in our world. Cell phones are used in the developing world to do everything because there aren't any other options. So all financial data is on those cell phones. We have disrupted new innovations, what are called disruptive, like Uber and Amazon, that are totally different economic models. And they will create new security concerns. They will. And so the person who's the next president of the United States has to be able to imagine now what that world is going to be like so that we have the regulatory and legal frameworks that we need. I probably spent more hours in the Situation Room discussing cybersecurity and the right and left margins of the use of cyber as both an offensive and as a defensive weapon than almost anything else I did, because it's very complicated, it's very difficult, but it is very essential.
Ray?
I'll just quickly add, this idea of encrypted communications is an incredibly complex issue, and the ambassador just discussed the economic problem with encrypted communications or the reasons we need encrypted communications. From a military perspective, You know, it's not only really how the encrypted communication issue inside the United States, it's really internationally. Yeah. And how as we're conducting operations around the world, do we get access to encrypted communication for us to be able to gain the intelligence necessary for us to do the things we need to do? And so what's not happened yet is we have not had the discussion on in international law on this issue. We really have not had a good discussion on U.S. law on this issue, and it's happening. And so the national security implications are significant. And I guess the only positive thing that I would bring from the Apple FBI is that it is bringing it to the attention of these are some of the problems that we're just beginning to face in this area, and we've got to solve them. And whether it takes legislative change, policy change, and then as Congressman Rogers said, Chairman Rogers said, there's probably technical solutions as well. But we have to get after this because, in my opinion, it's going to directly affect our national security if we don't solve the problem.
Wendy, let me ask you about moving on to Syria. Terrible civil war in Syria. 250,000 people have been killed. Millions have become refugees. It's a proxy war, both in terms of regional and world powers. President said Assad should be removed, and now everybody's involved in this fight. Russians, Iran, Hezbollah, everybody's shooting at each other. Do we have to make a choice between fighting Assad, removing Assad, and fighting ISIS? Some have suggested that we do, number one. And number two, could you comment on Russia's decision today, Putin's decision to begin withdrawing? What's the motivation behind that?
So first of all, on Assad, the reason why Assad needs to go, whether that is tomorrow or perhaps 18 months from now, which is the timetable in the UN Security Council resolution that within 18 months there would be some kind of an election to create a transitional governing authority, is because Assad has lost credibility with his own people, and because the Gulf Arab states will never stop the proxy war in Syria if Assad remains. So even if you agreed with Russia and Iran that Assad should stay because ISIL is more important, we need to fight ISIL, it won't happen. Because although the Gulf Arab states have agreed to having this peace negotiation, as you pointed out, it is a proxy war. It is not just an internal civil war. And they're not going to let go because the stakes of Iran's engagement in the Middle East is profound for Sunni Arabs because there's an underlying Sunni-Shia conflict that is going on, one of many conflicts going on, but that is certainly one of the fundamental ones. So Assad leaving is not just because the President of the United States said he must leave or because he used chemical weapons against his own people, which certainly sort of undermines his contract with protecting his own citizens, but because the civil war will never end because it's a proxy war for others as well. Now, the good news, before I get to the Russian news, which I'm not sure is good or bad, but I'll explain what I think it is that the ceasefire that was recently negotiated has held longer and better than most people ever thought it had a chance to. And that's crucial because people are getting aid because, as I think you all saw, Assad used starvation as a weapon of war. And literally, entire villages and towns were starved to death, literally. So that is a good thing. And today, Stefan de Mistura, the UN envoy, began the next round of peace negotiations, their proximity talks. That means nobody's in the same room together. He talks with one side in one room, and then he goes to the next room and talks to the other side, and then he goes back and forth, because putting them all in the room together, they would just scream and yell, and it would never get anywhere. So he plays the negotiator and the broker and tries to edge people towards a place where ultimately they can be in a room together. But today, as those peace talks started, President Putin of Russia said, we're going to begin to withdraw our forces out of Syria. Now, the fact that it happened today is, of course, no coincidence. And I think most analysts believe that he's trying to nudge the Syrian regime to negotiate seriously. It probably is very costly for Russia to have its troops there in the way it has, and their economy is in very bad shape. He probably is trying to affect the price of oil in some way by withdrawing from Syria and saying the world is going to calm down and we're going to solve the crude oil supply and try to stabilize prices. And he still has a naval port in Syria. He still has an air force base in Syria. He still has a relationship with Iran and through Iran with Hezbollah. And he may still have military advisors. So it is probably a good news, bad news story. And I'm not sure any of us know exactly how it's going to play out, but Putin is a very tactically smart person. I think this says to the world, I am a big, powerful player because I have done this today, and I have a big seat at this table in this peace negotiation. I'm doing all the right things, and so I come to this negotiation with more power. And at the end of the day, if the United States and Russia agree, it puts a lot of pressure on everybody else.
Ray, what's your solution to the Syria situation?
Well, I think, first off, the ambassador outlined it incredibly well. The one thing that I would add is, as she stated at the end, is that President Putin wants a say in the outcome of whatever this transitional government is, because Syria is deemed as important to the Russians for the warm water port that they have, and, oh, by the way, to maintain influence in the Middle East. And so I think that's why you're seeing him maneuver now again, because I believe he wants to be one of the very strong voices in how this turns out. But I would not mistake this for peace coming to Syria and Iraq.
Good point.
As was mentioned, you know, I would just tell you this is what you're seeing play out in Syria, what you're seeing play out in Iraq, what you're seeing play out in Yemen is a symptom of the underlying conflict between, some people call it Arab Persians, I tend to call it Sunni Shia, where you have this competition for control and hegemony of the region led by Saudi Arabia on the Sunni side, Iran on the Shia side, and this is going to continue to play out. And what you've seen with groups like ISIS is they are opportunists taking advantage of the failed and failing governments and the ungoverned territories, and they will continue to do that. And so this is just the beginning. At least if we can solve the problem of who is going to be the transitional government in Syria, we then can focus on ISIS. Because right now it's a bit confusing, because the Russians said they were going to come in to really go after ISIS, and we all know they really have not. The majority of the work they've done has been against the fighters fighting against the Assad government. And so it is really worsening the situation overall, although it's helping to solve the immediate problem of at least it started getting to ceasefire in Syria. So I guess what I'm saying is incredibly complex, no easy solutions. I believe there's a lot of political maneuvering going on to ensure that they can gain influence on the outcomes and to continue to play a key role in the Middle East. Russia wants to increase its international profile. And we can get into it more, but that's, I believe, is also related to what they do in Ukraine and other places as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. The one difference I have, if we're really going to get an effort here, and I always argue you need to set up your diplomats to be successful, is with Russia in the game, even at the negotiation table, our Sunni allies in the region go crazy. Why? Because he has picked his team. He said, Iran, the Shias, my team. Hezbollah, my team. And he went in, I'm not sure anyone was really surprised that he went in to protect his team. So when he was bombing American allied rebels, certainly didn't shock me because they were against Assad. So he was fortifying, I think, his position to make sure that Assad's troops had the chance to kind of shake themselves off and reposition themselves, which they did. Get some Hezbollah troops off the battlefield. That was causing some political angst from Iran, and Hezbollah was, you know, they were suffering casualties in a way they hadn't done really ever in their history. That was starting to create problems. He gave them space that I think bad space, or space that they badly needed. My argument is, we, if we're going to be for Sunnis beating ISIS a Sunni problem, we needed to be more committed to that effort, to that coalition. And yes, it was going to be some tough days for that coalition to be up and operating in eastern Syria, but we never really did that. And so what you'll do when I talk, and I'm sure you have these experiences as well, when you talk to our Sunni Arab partners in the region, they just don't trust us. They don't understand what we're doing. They say, well, if we are your allies in the region, why are you doing that? Why are you in bed with the Russians? They're trying to kill us. They're helping kill us. I think we miss the boat by saying, well, Russia's a big important player and we're just going to negotiate with them. It misses this piece of our Sunni Arab partners. And I don't think we'll ever get this right until we fix that problem. And what that looks like could take a couple of different forms, but we're going to have to fix that problem. And then I think you could get the credibility to negotiate with some of these factions in Syria to actually negotiate a ceasefire. They don't like it, they don't want it. They say you're negotiating with people who slaughtered our families in my home, right? That's a powerful place for them to be. We have to fix that attitude.
Okay, before we turn to questions from the audience, let me just ask Wendy, you have, in your experience at the State Department, negotiated with North Korea. You've been at the table during those negotiations. And then you obviously led the negotiations in dealing with Iran. What are the similarities and differences in dealing with North Korea and then dealing with Iran?
Every situation is sui generis. There are things to be learned from each, but they're quite different. I dealt with North Korea at the end of the Clinton administration. I didn't negotiate the agreed framework, which ensured that Ambassador Bob Gallucci did, which ensured that for the entire length of the Clinton administration, not one additional ounce of plutonium was created in North Korea. But we were concerned that North Korea was developing ballistic missile technology that would give them a delivery system if they ever did, in fact, get to a nuclear weapon. There wasn't a nuclear weapon yet at that time. Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader, with whom I met for 12 hours with Secretary Albright, had his own view of the world. And I joke that North Korea is a cult, more than a country. Iran is a country, but North Korea is more like a cult. Led by this leader who is really seen as a deity, is seen as godlike in his country, and all things flow from him, all things. And Kim Jong-il was brutal, but he was transactional. One could deal with him in return. We ended the Clinton administration without being able to make any kind of a deal. In part because it was the year we were having this little bit of a presidential problem. We thought we ought to brief the incoming administration, except November happened.
You didn't have an administration.
And we didn't have an administration. It wasn't until middle of December that the Supreme Court decided that election. So we couldn't bring this to closure in any way. Iran is a country. Its borders are open to Europe, even if they're not open to us. People are on the internet, even though there is censorship. They get around it. They see what people have. They see that the country next door to them, Turkey, which is an Islamic country, has all these great things, has all this commerce, and why can't they have it too? They have been engaging with the world trying to resolve this for some time. Most people think of Iran as a monolith, all led by the supreme leader and everybody just salutes and does what he says. That's not true. They have a modulus. They decide who gets to run for the modulus, so it's not a real true democracy, but there are elections, there are politics. I only half jokingly say there are hardliners and hardliners. There aren't moderates in the sense that we would think of moderates, but When President Rouhani was elected, he was more moderate than Ahmadinejad, which isn't hard to do. And it did open some space. And the international sanctions that were put on by the world, and with tremendous leadership from the United States Congress, brought Iran to the negotiating table. It never stopped their nuclear program. Sanctions never stopped their nuclear program. From the early 2000s until the time we got into serious negotiations, Iran went from 164 centrifuges to 19,000 centrifuges. So sanctions never stopped their program, but it did get them to the negotiating table, and the rest of the story is now history.
We'll have more to ask on that. Let me take a moment to recognize, if I can, our question review team. They're the people that are responsible for selecting the questions that are being presented to our speakers. And if you'll hold your applause, and I'll introduce the entire group. Julie Copeland, who's city editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Fran Gaver, who's a veteran question review team member. Doug McKnight, reporter for KAZU. And Don Miller, who is the executive editor of the Monterey Herald. If you will thank them, I would appreciate it. We had a great student program, as Sylvia pointed out, with the largest number of students we've ever had. We have a group of students that are representing those who attended that program. And at this time, I would like all of the students in attendance to stand, and please remain standing until I recognize each of your schools. Thank you very much, guys.
All right. That's good.
The schools, these students are from the California Maritime Academy, Defense Language Institute, Middlebury Institute of International Studies, the Monterey Coast Preparatory School, Navy Postgraduate School, San Jose State University. All of those are represented. Thank you very much.